guess I can't cuss. I'm being recorded. My name is Valerie, and I am an alcoholic. I can't believe y'all have AA out here in the middle of nowhere. I'm thinking, oh my God, I've got to get out of the city more. They can't be having AA out here. There can't be drunks out here. It's too pretty. But then there's Billy and Lynn, Randy, people I know that are bad alcoholics, should not drink. But it's really nice to be here. It was really a nice drive out. I actually messed up tonight. Last time I came out, I got the directions that Billy gave me were a little... Yeah, you kind of had to use your imagination with those directions. But this time was all my fault. I went right past the exit off 64 Zion. As my sponsor would say, you probably had your head up your ass thinking about yourself. And I did. Well, that's my one cuss word for tonight. But went right by and didn't even realize until I got to Charlottesville. So I know it's bad. So, but I'm very happy to be here. My sobriety date is October 13th, 1992. I just celebrated 13 years of continuous sobriety. My home group is the Jaywalkers group, and we meet twice a week in Richmond at Bon Air Presbyterian. So if you're ever in Richmond on Tuesday or Friday, come see us. Our Tuesday night meeting is a speaker meeting, and our Friday night meeting is a beginner's meeting. And we have a break, and then we have a closed discussion meeting, and we get our topics out of the big book. So it's pretty good. And it's pretty amazing, that meeting, actually. I'm really amazed at what it's become. It's just gotten huge. It's a really strong group. And when we started, it was a very, very small group of people that were interested in going to meetings and hearing the message of Alcoholics Anonymous shared in meetings. We wanted it to be a very recovery-based meeting, and we started with one meeting on Friday night. And I think we had 7 or 8 people for a good year. And then it went up to 15, and we were like, wow, we're growing. And now if you go to, and you know, and there's like 3 or 4 of us as home group members, myself, and I made some of the women I sponsored join that group, so I wouldn't be alone. But now we've got over 50 home group members. If you go there on a Friday night, there's over 100 people there. And it's just grown dramatically. But I think that's because my home group is really willing to follow the traditions. My home group is very active in service of being of service to the alcoholic who still suffers. When a newcomer comes to our group, they are accosted. I mean, it's like, you know, flies on poo. And I didn't say the S word. But, I mean, we really... and we carry the message into correctional facilities, and we carry the message into treatment facilities. And we meet regularly, and we have a GSR, and we have an intergroup rep, and we have somebody that represents us because we want to know what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous around us, within our districts, within our state, and at a national level. And I tell you, just, I don't even know why I'm talking about this, but a little interesting story is when the fourth edition came out, because we have representation at the district and the state level, we got a report back from our GSR, and we were looking at the fourth edition, and there were some things in the fourth edition in the beginning that said that there was no difference in an online AA meeting and the meeting around the corner, like what you guys do here, you know, where you have one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. I can see in the eyeball, you know, my home group knows when I'm in trouble. They know when I'm full of crap because they know me, because they can see me. And they were saying that there wasn't any difference, and we thought that there was a difference, that there was a big difference. So we wrote to GSO as a home group saying, we don't like this. We think there is a big difference, and could you all consider changing that? And we were about one of maybe 20 groups across the country that wrote in. But because we cared and because we wrote in, that stuff was changed. So if you look at the fourth edition printings now, it doesn't say that anymore. Because there is a difference. And there was just a group conscience from across the country that said something. So being a part of your home group is really important. Having a voice in Alcoholics Anonymous is really important. I'm not here to give a service talk, but anyway, it's all important. It all goes to being in all three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been around AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, since 1982. I first came into AA when I was 15 years old. And I came in after only drinking about a year. But what I did in that period of a year, alcohol was such magic to me that I pursued that at the expense of everything, I was a pretty good student, and I was involved in sports and bands, God help me, but I was a flute player. And but anyway, once I had my first drink was, well, when I first got drunk, let me put it that way, because I had sips of my parents' beer, wine, or their nasty scotch at the time. And that's when I was a social drinker. That's what I consider my social drinking period. Because once I started to drink, something happened, and it was such magic. It changed me so dramatically that I pursued that at the expense of everything. Everything. Went from, you know, pretty good student, straight S, was labeled ungovernable by the state of Florida, habitual runaway, habitual truant, and transient youth centers, detention centers, the whole gamut. And all of that was around alcohol and drugs. Every single bit of it. I just went bad, you know. So I don't know what happened. I just went bad. And, you know, and my parents were sending me to psychiatrists trying to figure out what's wrong with your girl. And one of the therapists that they'd sent me to see said to my parents, your daughter's got an alcohol and drug problem. You need to put her in a treatment center. So I was put in a treatment center. I was 15 going on 16. After only about a year of drinking. So I was in that treatment center, and that's when insurance was still good. That's when you could go for like 90 days, and they paid for it all. It was good. It's not like that today. But anyway, so it was 1982. It was down in Jacks Beach, Florida, and I wasn't a good treatment center participant. I never liked to follow the rules. The rules do not apply to me, and I can still suffer from that today. You know, when I was at the Big Book meeting, we were talking about inventory, and one of the and I haven't talked about it a lot, and it's happened in the last 6 months, but I was fired from my job because I don't want to follow the rules. I want to do it my way because I think that I'm right. And, you know, just arrogant and grandiose. So I wasn't a good treatment center participant. I snuck out. I had drugs snuck in. I was constantly sneaking over the boy side. I was just not, I didn't follow the rules. And, you know, if you're good when you're in treatment and you do what you're supposed to do, you get to move up days and levels. So you could be on level 4, day 5. And, you know, with all that comes privileges. And I was such a rule breaker that when I left, after being there 90 days, I was on day 1, level 1. I mean, I was starting to move into negative days at that point, just because I could never follow the rules. But the good thing that happened to me was that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. All I knew is all my life I felt different. All my life I felt afraid. All my life I felt separate from everybody else. All my life I seemed to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing. I couldn't connect with people. I was just envious of people who seemed to be able to fit in. I mean, I just couldn't fit in anywhere, and it actually took me a while to fit into Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like very much an outsider, too, in AA. I just had real problems connecting with people. And very afraid of what other people thought of me. And I was so self-centered or so turned inward that, I was terrified. You know, if you're in a public restroom, I just can't, I got a shot bladder, I just can't do it. I can't get up and walk across the room. I'm terrified to do it because I'm afraid of what you're going to be thinking or what you're maybe saying or you're going to make fun of me, and I'm afraid to talk to people because everything I say comes out wrong or it's inappropriate. And I don't mean to be that way, but it just, that's how I am. That's why I loved alcohol because it made all that stuff shut up. I mean, it quieted all that stuff where I just didn't care anymore. And even when I was drunk, I was inappropriate. I was insane. When I drank, I just didn't care anymore. So anyway, I mean, I'm one of those crazy drunks, you know. I'm crazy sober, and I'm crazy drunk, you know, unless I'm living a spiritual life sober. I mean, I can lead just an ugly life, an insane life sober, stark raving sober, as I can out there drinking. But anyway, so I was introduced to AA, and I went in and out of AA for a while. It didn't really stick. When I went into my first meeting, you know, this is in 1982, and I was in Florida, and there weren't a lot of young people coming into AA. I thought I was different. You know, everybody was very old to me there. You know, crotchety people. And I absolutely compared myself out. I didn't try to identify with the people there. And back then, too, some of the older guys that had been there, the real crusty ones, would say, girl, you need to, well, they didn't say it like that. They said, you need to go home and do what your parents are asking you to do. Be a good girl. You don't have to do what we have done. And you're not an alcoholic yet, is basically what they're saying. You can stop it now, if you try real hard. but for me, I was already what the book calls a potential alcoholic, which means I'm alcoholic. I was already there. So it became my personal mission to prove to them that I was drunk, an alcoholic, and that I belonged. Because you can't tell me what I am or what I'm not, and I'll do the opposite of what you're saying. So I started stealing their money to buy booze. I stole the key to the clubhouse, and that's where I would take my friends to party, was at the AA clubhouse. And I stole their money. I would show up at the meetings drunk. Just became very belligerent. Very, you know, I won't say it, I'll just do it. I was a very angry person, too. Very violent as well. I'd go after people physically if you pissed me off. But I was either in a rage or cowering in the corner, is really what I was. Cowered either way, you know. But anyhow, so I went in and out. When I was 17, I got into a lot of legal trouble, and it was either A, you're going to get sober again, or B, you're going to go back to juvie. So, of course, I chose sobriety, like any good alcoholic would. I'm in trouble now. And I swore at that time, I was in enough pain, and I felt bad enough that I thought I could get sober. I made this decision, I'm going to get sober and stay sober for the rest of my life. And I am done. I'm at the end of my rope. I've had enough. And I got sober, and I stayed sober for 3.5 years. And I moved out to Los Angeles. My father, who's now got 21 years sober, he had to be 5 or 6 years sober at the time. But I went out there and was living with him and mooching off of him. And I really kind of manipulated my way out there. I dropped out of high school. I just couldn't handle it. I just couldn't hang. You know, I don't like responsibility anyway. But if I could get out of it, I would. And I was just crazy. I was just nuts. And also a huge thief. I stole all the time. And I was an equal opportunity thief. I would steal from family. I would steal from friends. And I would help you look for it. And, I mean, I would. I mean, that's how whacked out I was. You know, I stole from department stores. I mean, I was just a huge thief. I stole all the time for a long time, drunk or sober. I stole. Because the world owed me something. I always believed that you owed me something, and I carried that in through a line. Randy knows, long time into sobriety. I remember with Randy. Randy was like sane for a long time before I got sane. And her and I used to have the same sponsor. And she would like go up to up north. And I was thinking about her today because of a sweater that she gave me. And I was looking at that today while I was changing stuff around. But anyway, if somebody went away, then when they came back, they better come back bearing gifts. Do you owe me something? I actually had a roommate in sobriety, and she was getting ready to get a settlement that was going to be settled favorably for her from a car accident she got in. And I truly believe that she owed me some of that money. Just a real sense of entitlement. The world owes me, and you owe me too. And if I can't con and manipulate you into giving it to me, I will just go take it. I mean, and you know what's so funny is I really thought for a long time I was a nice person. Yeah, I really did. I thought I was a nice person. But I'm not. Or I wasn't. Okay, I'm a lot nicer today. So I was dry for about 3.5 years. My life was real, real crazy. I went to a meeting every day, though. I had a sponsor in name only, which is my favorite kind, because they don't get into your life. They don't poke around. They don't ask you any questions. They don't ask you to do anything. You know, I made a feeble attempt at the steps, and really the only reason I got a sponsor, my father picked my sponsor for me, is because I wanted my dad to keep giving me money so I didn't have to work. That's it. It's the only reason. I'll do what you need me to do. I'll play the show as long as I get what I want from you. And I'd endure the lectures too. I'd show up and endure the lectures and all that stuff so I could get the money so I didn't have to work. But anyway, I went to a meeting every day. Was stealing all the time. Was running around chasing boys. As a matter of fact, this guy, Big Book Max, said to me, "Girl, you need to sit down, shut up, and keep your legs crossed. You're missing it." You know, this is not what AA is, but that's my version of working with others. You know, let me find a young thing. I'll show them what it's all about. But, you know, I wasn't thinking that way. But, I mean, relationship after relationship, no morals, no center, no moral compass whatsoever. Went to the AA dances. We called those the 13-step dances. Nobody knows what that is. Ask Billy. He knows. I'm just kidding. Don't ask Billy. Ask Randy. She knows. But going to the 13-step dances, that's what we called them, so we can find our hookup. And just running around crazy. Just insane. As a result of living like that, I drank again. Happened just like that. There was absolutely no effective mental defense. And I stopped going to AA meetings totally because I met a man who wasn't in AA and he wanted to take care of me. As a matter of fact, he told me I was his diamond in the rough, which was a big mistake. Never tell a girl that, or a girl like me that, because that's my angle then. I got my angle. And I was a master at keeping people off balance so that I could continue to get, so I could manipulate you to get what I needed. So, because I don't want to take any responsibility for who I am in my life at all. I don't even want to take responsibility for what I think. Tell me what to think. Tell me what to do. Tell me who I am. Tell me I'm okay. Blah, 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 blah. All that stuff. So, anyway, I stayed out there for 4 years. Moved from L.A. to Atlanta. Was in Atlanta for a couple years. Met this guy, you know, got married. I had to do a lot of hard work to get this man to marry me. I mean, there was a lot of... I had to work hard to make that happen. When I was in Georgia, one of the things that I thought would... I didn't want to be an alcoholic anymore. As a matter of fact, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I was just young. And I just had issues. And it was because of how I was raised. Because I came from an alcoholic home. And because my dad was violent, because my stepdad was violent, because I moved all over the country, because I'm a Navy brat, and it's all because of this other stuff. But now I've got a man, we've got a house, we got this, we got that. If I am a victim of that delusion that if I get all this out here cleaned up and straight and running right, then I'll be okay in here. And one of my great ideas when I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, one of the things that I thought would make me whole, would make me complete, was if I raised sheep. I really believed if I was raising sheep, out there doing the sheep do back to nature thing, that everything was going to be okay. I collected animals. But didn't take care of them. I've had a lot of amends that I've had to make towards animals because I just collect them all. Collect, but didn't take care of them. I couldn't take care of nothing. I can give you my attention for 5 minutes. And then I'm bored. I'm going to go somewhere else. That's the kind of person. I know nothing about commitment. I'm a sprinter. I ain't a long distance runner, you know. So it was just crazy. And I got involved in the music industry and was running around with those people because they partied like I did. And I could live a certain way and it was okay. And then my now ex got transferred up to New York, and it was like just in time, man, because I was starting to burn a lot of bridges. I was starting to have a lot of consequences for my drinking where people didn't want to hang out with me anymore. So I was up there. I had gotten pregnant. I had a child. I was going to be good for my son, not drink for my son anymore. And I was never a beer drinker. I was a liquor drinker. I thought beer was for wimps. And I was a real believer in liquor's quicker and let's do shots. I went to the doctor and I was breastfeeding, and my doctor said, if you drink beer, and I didn't drink beer at the time, if you drink some beer, it'll help, you know, it's a whole yeast, let your milk hang down. Girls understand, breastfeeding girls. So I said, okay, that's all it took, was one drink, and I was gone, just gone. The last 2 years of my drinking were extremely ugly. I led a very, very, very ugly life. I was not a good wife. I was not a good mother. I was not a good employee. I caused so much wreckage and havoc because of how I was living. As a matter of fact, and I think I shared some of this when I was at the Big Book study, when I went back to make amends to my ex-husband, he told me flat out, he goes, that 4 years I was with you were the worst 4 years of my life. I'm so glad we're not married anymore because I was just such a taker. I absolutely was that tornado roaring through the lives of others. Sweet relationships were dead. Hearts were broken. Promises were broken. I was not a good person. And I was leading a double life. I got involved with artists up there, and I was a fine art rep by day, and I was hanging out in Harley bars, biker bars at night with my little do-rag on, you know. Coming to in the morning, and I've got burns all over my legs and don't know where I've been, who I've been with. Just really insane. Really insane. One night, my father called me out of the blue, and I, for some reason, answered the phone because typically, at that point, I didn't answer the phone. The machine got it. And then if I wanted to talk to you, I'd pick up the phone. For whatever reason, that night I answered the phone, and it was my father, and he basically talked to me about AA again, and 12-stepped me back into AA. I wish I could tell you that that was the last, that that was the magic, and I haven't had a drink since, but that's not what happened. I made a decision, well, when I move down to Richmond, Virginia, I'm going to get sober, and I'm going to stay sober, and it never occurred to me. But I'm going to party while I'm up here in New York. It never occurred to me that when I moved down to Richmond that I wouldn't be able to stop. That never occurred to me. Because I've been able to do that before. I could stop all the time. It was staying stopped that I had a problem with. I just couldn't stay stopped. So I get down to Richmond. And I go to my first AA meeting. And I feel like I'm home. I feel like I've heard How It Works read for the first time, and I'm just a little, I know that that's where I'm supposed to be. And I get a sponsor right away. That sponsor ended up being committed a couple weeks later, but she was perfect for me at that time. So we understood each other. It may have been a little longer than a couple weeks, but anyway, I was going to a meeting every day, and I wanted to be here. I wanted to be in AA. That want was not enough. I ended up drinking two more times. And my last drink was up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I went to go see this artist and with my ex and my son. And I went to talk to him about being his rep. And I don't know what the hell I was thinking. I mean, grandiosity, that's it. But anyway, I go into his studio. You know, we always want to be somebody. I'm going to be somebody one day, you know. But he's got whiskey. And I'm going to AA, and I want to be in AA, and I want to be sober. Want to be. He's got whiskey there. And I said, what you doing with that? He goes, you want a drink? Yeah, I do. Just like that. And two shots of whiskey, and then my ex shows up and picks me up. That is the worst thing in the world. Once you started drinking, to have that shit interrupted. But, you know, I'm just starting to feel warm. You know, it feels good. You know? It was awful. It is the worst feeling in the world. So later that night, I'm trying to finish the job, and I can't. I get about down maybe half a beer, and I just can't. And I don't know what's happened, but I just can't. And I want to desperately bad. I want to get just annihilated, oblivion. I just want to pass out. And I can't do it. And I really believe that God touched me there. I really believe that I stepped into God's grace, or God's grace was present with me. God's grace in my life. However you want to say that, something happened that I did not do. Because I haven't had a drink since then. And I did nothing to deserve the gift that I was given. Nothing. I did not come into AA a nice person. I didn't come into AA on a winning streak. I didn't come into AA with my family intact, having harmed nobody. I came in here a liar. I came in here a cheat. I came in here a thief and a destroyer of lives. That's how I showed up to AA. And I was given the greatest gift that I've ever been given. And I did nothing to deserve it. Nothing. I can't say there's one redeemable thing that I had done up to that point in my life that made me worthy to deserve the gifts that I've been given. People like me die all the time. All the time. Why me? I don't know. But I do know I'm so grateful that I've been given the gifts, and it's absolutely incumbent upon me to give myself fully here, because it's the only thing that's worked, and I've got another opportunity. So I'm willing to do what I need to do to keep the gift. It's the best life I've ever had. I didn't know that when I first got here. All I knew was I'm in pain and I want to die. That's all I knew. And very, very, very sick. Very spiritually ill. So we've given the greatest gift of one of the greatest, the first greatest gift I've ever been given. I've been given many more since then. Anyway, so I got sober. Was given the gift of sobriety. And I went to a meeting every day. I got another sponsor. I called that woman every day. Drove her fucking nuts. Don't do anything with this. Burn this. I want to take this off and turn it off now. Got a home group. And just started doing the deal. I left my first husband. I was still very, very sick when it came to relationships. I already had a couple men lined up so I could jump right into another relationship, because that's how I roll, girl. And so we always got to have one waiting in the wings. Because I'm afraid. Because I live a life of, my life is driven by fear. I'm driven by fear. I can't stand the thought of being alone. I won't know what to do with myself. I'll be so uncomfortable. I won't know what to do. But anyway, so I left my husband. Relieved him of my presence. My son was about 2 when I got sober. And my first 9 months was, I was just bouncing off the walls. Bing, 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 bing. It was crazy. And I met this group of people, and they had this group going all called Fourth Dimension. And they were a big book meeting. And started going to that meeting. And I was amazed when I went to that meeting that How It Works came out of the big book. I had no idea. Had no clue. That there were actually directions in the book. I mean, I was just blown away. I had no idea. And I started reading that stuff and finding myself in there. I was identifying with stuff. I mean, that's the beauty of our literature. It's there to help us identify. Are you a hopeless chronic alcoholic? Because our life depends upon that identification. and it enforces people that are new. Their life depends upon them hearing what the problem is and then a solution. You know, I drank like that. I felt like that. You know, I acted like that. I thought like that about alcohol. I drank like a pig like that, too. I led a real ugly life, too. I was a liar, too. I was a cheat, too. I was depressed, too. You know? This is why we share the stuff that's ugly. Because we're such actors. You know, this is what I want you to see, and I got it all together. And it's not true. It's just not. So anyway, I couldn't believe it, that there were these directions on how to start and end your day. Couldn't believe it. So I got another sponsor, and, you know, she kind of took me through the steps. I didn't take the steps per se out of the book, kind of, but not really. But I started sponsoring people, going to meetings, got real active in that home group. I was on fire for AA. I became a little evangelist, you know, I was going to save the world. And, you know, and just doing everything that I could. And I was learning how to work. I didn't know how to work. You know, I didn't have an education, didn't have a GED, nothing. I didn't know how to pay bills. I didn't know how to manage money. You know, it was a very rough time. And, you know, being a single mom and trying to be present for that was very difficult for me, to be present as a parent. It was uncomfortable. I had to give up myself, and that's just uncomfortable. I don't like to do that unless it's, you know, immediate return to me. I'm not one of those people that's like a natural mother. It's not me. So I really struggled with all that stuff. In about 3.5 years, I fell into a really dark place sober. Really, really dark. Was very, very depressed. Was suicidal. Couldn't work. I'd been working up to that point. But I couldn't work anymore. You know, I've been in sobriety and had no job, no car, no place to live, no money, nothing. And my sponsor saying, asking me, well, that stuff will take care of itself. Tell me what you're doing in Alcoholics Anonymous today. You know, and you just want to scream and go, no, that's nothing to do with it. I got to get a car. I got to get a job. I got to get this. And, you know, in sponsorship, and AA says, what, how many meetings are you going to? How are you trying to carry the message? Have you written inventory? Have you made your amends? That kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that pisses us off, you know? But that's the answer. We attack stuff on the flank. We don't go head on. We do these things, the rest works out. What's your primary purpose, Valerie? And it's so hard to grasp. And most of my relationship with God at that point was very intellectual. I'd had like my first like, yoo-hoo, pink cloud spiritual awakening. But then life came to visit. And then I really had to rely upon God. Then I really had to start growing up. And it was a whole different ballgame. And I was on the floor because of it. Because there were a lot of things that hadn't changed. So anyway, I met this woman, Camille. I got to be her host at this conference. And she took one look at me and she said, girl, you're a mad dog alcoholic and you're going to die. You know, she's like one of those bad Louisiana psychics. You're going to die. You know, unless you get into all three parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what the hell she was talking about. What do you mean? I'm going to a meeting every day. Blah, 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 blah. What do you mean you can get in all three parts of AA? And she started to talk to me about that. And I called her up and I asked her to help me. And she lived in Louisville, Kentucky. There wasn't anybody in Richmond, Virginia who was doing that. So I borrowed $40, went on out there. Randy went with me. Got a speeding ticket on the way, because I get speeding tickets all the time because my life's so unmanageable. You know, I'm a walking speeding ticket. As a matter of fact, I think I got like 6 speeding tickets in a period of a year because I was always in a hurry. You know, hey, running here, always running late. You know, I was talking to this guy on the phone on the way here, and he was being really inconsiderate of some other people, and he's like, and he got mad at them for them getting mad at him. And something that Camille told us early on was, you know, you're so self-centered. All you think about is you. You're late everywhere you go. You're chronically late. We don't run on your time. What, is your time more valuable than mine? And it's like, oh, Well, since you put it that way, you know. But I never let that. I was like, I'll just get there when I get there. I'll be there when I be there. Or, you know, I'm running late. And so, you know. But anyway, but that woman, she said, you know, we're going to start at the very beginning of the book, and we're going to read this word for word. And where it says write, we're going to write. Where it says pray, we're going to pray. When it says go here, do this, we're going to go there, do that. And are you willing to do it? You know, are you willing to take the steps thoroughly? I'm going to walk with you. Are you willing to start conducting yourself like a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous and follow these traditions and start bringing these into your life and start bringing these into your home group? Are you willing to do that? Are you willing to start being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous and to other alcoholics and to learn and grow with the concepts? You've got 36 spiritual principles here. Are you going to give yourself to it or aren't you? Because someone like you isn't going to make it unless you do. Or you can continue on as you are, sober, wanting to die, and hope that things get better. And that's the place I came to, of just that utter hopelessness and futility of life. Our book describes it really well, as I have been living it. Leaving aside the drink question. It's not about drink anymore. They tell why living was so unsatisfactory. And it had everything to do with how I conducted myself in my life and my relationship with God. And I was coming face to face with that. It was time that I grow up in a lot of ways and also develop a relationship with a power greater than myself and stop running my life. Because all the consequences that I was experiencing were consequences of me living on self-will. That's how I ended up in the depression I was in. I want what I want. I'm going to do what I want to do. You know, it's the story of my life. So, you know, I used to go, I don't understand why I'm depressed. You know, and she would say to me, well, you know, Valerie, there's a price to pay for everything. Price to pay for everything here. You can run your life, take the consequences thereof, which for you manifests in suicidal depression. Or you can let God run your life and take the consequences thereof. It's your choice. It's always my choice. It's always your choice too. How am I going to live today? Am I going to live on the spiritual basis of life? Or am I going to run the show? And trust me, I still run the show plenty. I have character defects out the yazoo still. But I'm real grateful for them today because they always take me back to God. And they always force me to take a look at me and to surrender some more. So anyway, the woman saved my life. And it took me a while to come out of that depression. It took a lot of work, a lot of work in AA, a lot of inventory to write, a lot of unfinished amends that I needed to make because, quite frankly, there were a lot of amends that I wasn't willing to make. I just wasn't willing to do it. I didn't want to pay back all that money from stuff that I stole. What time is it? You got to tell me when it's time. Oh, you can give me a little what? Thank you. There's a lot of stuff I haven't been willing to do. But she helped me look at the first step. She helped me to look at that I'm absolutely 100% powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable. She brought that right on home to me and helped me to realize that I didn't do anything to deserve this. I couldn't drink even though I wanted to. That I lost the power to choose whether I was going to drink or not drink. I don't have that choice. It's gone. It's gone. I don't even have it today. I'm just as powerless over alcohol today as the day I walked into the doors of AA. Her book describes it really well. It says, we're like men who have lost their legs. We never grow new ones. Never means never. She'd say, Valerie, what part don't you understand? The now or the ver? Never. Never means never. I never grow new choice. If I'm waking up in the morning saying, oh, I choose not to take a drink today, I'm deluding myself. Either this is something that was a gift for me, or it's something that I produced. Hello. Welcome. The inability to choose on whether I'm going to drink or not is what makes me alcoholic. That's what powerlessness is. I don't have any power. None. I cannot bring to mind with sufficient force the suffering and humiliation of a week, a month, a year, or years ago. I am without defense against the first drink. What provides the defense? Power greater than yourself. What makes your life manageable? Power greater than yourself. Of myself, I am nothing. If of myself, I am nothing, if I've given it my best shot and I've still failed, then I need to develop a relationship with a power greater than me. If what I'm doing is not working. She had me look at my beliefs about God. We did that very thoroughly through We Agnostics. And I had a lot of funky beliefs about God. I really believed that God had favorites. I really believed that there were the haves and the have-nots, and I was going to be a have-not for the rest of my life. Because I would compare myself to other people. I would compare myself to your spiritual experience, or your spiritual experience, or your spiritual experience. You seem to be getting it. Why aren't I getting it? You know? How come your life is so great and mine is shit? Or crap? Try not to cuss. You should have never said, Valerie, don't cuss. Because the moment you said, Valerie, don't cuss, I got to cuss. That's a lie, by the way. You need to know that, too. Because I guarantee if my sponsor was sitting right there, I wouldn't be cussing that at all. But I had a lot of funky ideas about God. I had no real faith in God. My relationship with God was very intellectual. I loved to read about it and talk about it, but actually rely on that and trust that scared me to death. Like, oh Lord, what if God wants me to be a nun in South America and never have sex or make money or drive a fast car ever again? I can't do it. What an order. I can't do it. But if it means I can't have that relationship, or I can't have that job, or I can't go there, I'm afraid, because I think I know what I need and what I want. And I got news for you and for me. I've never known what I needed. Ever. So I got into enough pain where I was willing to trust it. And our book describes it really well. It says, we step from bridge to shore. Friendly hands stretched out and welcome. You know, come on over here. The water's fine. And those are the people in AA who make you crazy. We're like, let go. It's going to be fine. Trust God. Everything's going to be okay. You know, I went to thrive with those people. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not okay. You know, I hated them. Because I couldn't get what they were getting. What seemed so easy for them. I couldn't get it. But I would not let go. But when I got enough pain, I let go. And then I found out what they were talking about. That power is there. It's very real. I absolutely believe down here and know from my own experience now that no matter what happens, I will be okay. No matter what. That God's will really is the best thing for me. It is better than anything I can plan. And I absolutely will sell myself short. And I've learned that from letting go and trusting what our literature says, that if it was true for those crazy drunks who started this thing, and it's true for my sponsor's sponsor, and the people I surround myself with, then it must be okay for me too. Maybe it's true for me too. Maybe I'm not the exception to the rule. Maybe I'm not so awful or so bad or so sick or too smart or whatever to get this thing. Because, you know, our ego can generate all kinds of crap on why we should trust in a power greater than ourselves. So I went on and did third step. I went on and I wrote inventory. It was a very touchy inventory. It was my first one. I'd written all four columns, and I'd never written inventory like that. I could no longer say my part in inventory. I had to write down where I was wrong. I was busted on that really early. Where does it say in the big book, my part? It says we disregard the other person involved entirely. Once I've gotten to the fourth column on resentment inventory, I disregard them entirely. It's not their inventory. It's mine. They don't. All my life I've been waiting for you to change so I can be okay. Ain't gonna happen. All I've got is me. All I can do is take responsibility for me. and what I'm doing and how I'm living. So I took some of the most impossible resentments. Most impossible resentments where I couldn't possibly be wrong. Ever. And submitted them to that process and I got free. I had a really interesting experience with Fifth Stepping. Randy and I drove out to Louisville, Kentucky. We got sat in rooms. Well, no, you were with Debbie, I think, first. I don't know. But anyway, she was out there listening. I got sat in a room. I don't know any of these crazy women. And I'm in there, and Camille says to me, somebody's coming in to hear your inventory. What do you mean I'm not reading it to you first? No, you're reading it to so-and-so first. And I mean, it was a very touchy-feely inventory. You know, I still believed I was different. I was just full of pain, suffering. And I'm still a victim in a lot of ways, you know. And but it was the best thing that happened to me. And actually, our book talks about it, that we can read our inventory to person or persons. And she had me read that to multiple people. And the reason why is because my ego was so huge, because I thought I was so different from everybody else. I was terrified to let you know what I was really thinking, how I was really living, what I was really doing. I thought I was different. I didn't realize I'm just as whacked out as you are. I'm just as dishonest as you are. I'm just as fearful as you are. I'm just as much a taker as you are. I'm just as inconsiderate as you. I'm just a mess, just like everybody else. You know? My stuff is no uglier than anybody else's out there. I also realized through the process of writing inventory and hearing other people's inventory over the course of years, is that I am capable of anything, given the right circumstances. I'm capable of anything. Anything you can think of, I'm capable of it, given the right circumstances. I like to tell myself, well, no, I'm not. But I've learned a lot because I used to be so extremely judgmental. That's one of the things that showed itself to me over the course of time. Of writing inventory and hearing other people's inventory. Love to judge you. I would never do that. I'm better than you. Better than you. I'm better than all of you. Most of my inventory, when I look at third comments, like I either think I'm better than you or I feel like I'm less than you. It's one or the other. You're not treating me right. Or you're not treating me at all. Damn it. And you need to start treating. So anyway, but I get to see all that. And then I got to go ask God to remove it. Powerful experience, step 6 and 7. And the 12 and 12 talks about it beautifully. It says that's when we get changed. It's when the boys turn into men, or however they put that. And the girls turn into women. That is actually where I am changed. If I had the power to change me, I wouldn't be going to God asking for God's help and God to remove my defects of character that are standing in the way. If I could do it on my own. If I could get myself sober, if I could fix my anger problem, my depression problem, my stealing problem, my lying problem, my can't work problem, my feeling of separate, my fear, if I could poof that all away, I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't need you, and I wouldn't need a power greater than myself. I don't work on my problems today. I don't work on my issues. I don't even work on my self-esteem. Actually, it's become a non-issue. I don't even really think about myself like that. And that's a gift. Because I always thought about myself. I was always working on my anger problem and my self-esteem. Always. Loved it. It was very exciting. Very exciting time. But it doesn't work. This is about dying to self. It says self is the problem. We get rid of it entirely. And there seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without God's aid. Anything that has self involved of, I want. I don't want any part of it. I want to die to self. I want to be reborn in spirit. And that's what this is all about. Waking up. Because I've been asleep all my life. I need to wake up. So, the steps do that. They wake you up. And steps are not for me. They're not so I feel better. The only reason I take the steps and get changed is so I can be more useful to you. The first 11 steps get me ready for the 12th step. The cool thing is that I start to live a different life because of it. I change because of it, and I do feel better because of it. So I'm not leading another life anymore. Had to go out and make amends. I didn't want to make amends. I especially didn't want to make financial amends. I was one of those people, it's my money, it's mine. I have none. so I'm going to keep everything. I owed thousands and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, a lot of money. And I think I was making $12,500 a year when I first got to that step. Could barely make ends meet, could barely see myself. And Camille said to me, well, I don't care. You pick one. You call and you arrange the best deal possible. I don't care if you're paying $5 a month. You do it. And you pay your bills too. No. I mean, I hated writing out my bills. Hated giving money away. I mean, I just wanted to live for free. I mean, I really did. And, I mean, it was, I can't tell you how difficult that was for me. And, I started making those $5 amends, and it was very difficult. I don't ever want to go through that again, ever. But I started making those $5 amends, you know, a little while, and I kept doing it. Pretty soon I was making $20 amends. Then I was making $100 amends. Then I was making $500 amends. Then I was making $1,000 amends. The more willing I became to pay that money back, more money started to come into my life in order to do that. I don't understand how that works. And I'm, you know, she also made me go back to school and get my GED, which at the time, I didn't see the point. I don't need an education. I'm going to make it on my own. You know, she said, just go get it. Just do it. Okay, I'll do it. I don't want to, but I'm going to do it. That's sponsorship. Sponsorship tells you to do all kinds of stuff. I don't want to do it. We don't want to do it. But I have to trust that what somebody's asking me to do is for my own benefit. They're trying to help me, not harm me. So, and that would help me later on with a job. I couldn't have gotten a job that I ended up ultimately getting fired from, but I couldn't have gotten that job if I didn't have my GED. I couldn't have the job that I have today if I didn't have my GED. And I do okay today. I do pretty well today. And that's not because I'm some great person. It's because I live in the world of the Spirit. That's it. It really is about good things happen when you put yourself in God's hands. If there's work for God that God wants you to do, all barriers go away. You will be able to be self-supporting through your own contributions. In every area of your life. That's what's happened to me. Self-supporting my own contributions financially, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. One thing that Don said to me, I ended up getting a different sponsor, Don, and he just passed away recently. Anyway, but I remember calling Don up one time, and he said, I was one of those people, in awe of this man, just in awe of him. Just one of the most incredible AA members I've ever seen in my entire life. And I miss him so much. I miss him dearly. I loved him like nobody's business. He was my greatest teacher in so many ways. One of the things that he said to me once, I called him up and, you know, I just wanted him to run my life because he had a great one. I just wanted him to tell me what to do. I wanted him to make my decisions for, should I get married, Don? What do you think? Why are you asking crap like that? You make your own decision. Why don't you go pray about it? Why don't you follow your intuitive thought? Don, do you think I should do this? Well, why are you asking me stuff like that? I don't know. You know, he goes, you're always trying to steal my experience. You're a thief. You're a spiritual thief. Why don't you actually go pray about it, take some action, and have your own experience. Quit trying to steal mine. You're so lazy. You're so spiritually lazy. It's like, okay, you know, do you still love me? Yeah. Oh, God. But it was true. Still being a thief. Tell me what to do. Tell me what to think. You know, instead of taking the actions and praying about it and then calling up my sponsor and saying, you know, I've done this. I've prayed about it. This is what's coming to me. What do you think? This is what I'm getting ready to go do. What do you think? I prayed about this. this is where I'm led, or I'm afraid to go do this, but it looks like this is where I'm being led. You know, then somebody can walk with you. A good sponsor doesn't want to run your life. They can't even run their own. A sponsor walks with you and will share their experience, strength, and hope with you. You know, and I love it. I heard somebody say one time, you know, I've got a couple gals that I sponsor that are just, you know, they're just, you know, I sponsor some wolves, I sponsor some weasels, I sponsor some rattlesnakes, and I sponsor some lambs, and I sponsor some lions. A couple of them, a couple of the weasels. You know, I don't even remember what the hell I was going to say now, but anyway, they just try to weasel their way into, tell me what to do, tell me how to think, make my decisions for me. Just very manipulative. And because they don't want to think on their own. My biggest problem is I don't have to trust and rely upon God. You be my God. You do it. Because you're something I can see and you're tangible. You know, that's one of the greatest gifts that He gave me, was to really get my reliance off of things human, off myself, off my own mind, off things human, and onto a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem, which will give me all the power that I need in order to live. He was really good at that. So, I don't know where I was going with telling my sponsorship story, but I sponsor a lot of women. They've taught me a lot. They drive me crazy, and sometimes I love them. Sometimes I want to fire them all and run away and move to Alaska. And sometimes I'm with them and I'm at my very best. And I can't imagine it being any other way. It has taught me more about who I am and who I'm not than anything else. And it has provided an opportunity for me to think of someone else besides myself for a little while. And also, when I'm telling you not to steal, I can't be stealing. While I'm asking you to write inventory, I've got to be keeping my own house in order. If I'm asking you to go keep a commitment at a correctional facility, I better be keeping my commitments at the correctional facility. You know? It helps me to toe the line. It helps me to walk what I talk. And the women I sponsor are invited into my life. They get to see how I live, how I work, what my home life is like. Because I think it's important. And they need to know that I'm human. And they need to know that I make mistakes. And that I'm not all well yet. Because, you know, sometimes we like to put sponsors on a pedestal. And they don't belong there. They're just drunks. And I'm saying that because I've put my sponsors on a pedestal too. And I've just learned that in being sponsored and in sponsoring. But my primary purpose is to stay sober and to carry this message. The book's very clear. It's this message. It's not my opinion. It's the message that's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the message that has depth and weight. That's the message that saved my life. So that's the message that I carry. And I'm very honored to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm done.